Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Monday. It is the 20th of November. We are just a few short days away from Turkey Day and getting an extended weekend, which I know I am very much looking forward to. I am not a turkey fan, but my wife does get me a ham every year. Well, I say for me. She does it because the kids and the grandbabies want it. I just happen to be there, and I'm like, oh, I love ham. So I get a little bit of that as well. So today we are, as Terry Fletcher so aptly named it, the Fab Four. Scott Kraft is somewhere flying over the Pacific Ocean on his way to New Zealand. And Christine Hall is traveling. So we wish them safe voyages and safe travels. But I get to hang out with three of my friends today. Paul Spencer, who apparently his razor no longer works.
It's the season. He fits the season.
Tis the season. I think Paul's actually going for... he didn't want anybody to know this, but he is Billy Bob Thornton's replacement on Bad Santa. So I think he's growing out his Santa beard. But anyways, I have three of my favorite people, Paul Spencer, Stephanie Howard, and Terry Fletcher. We're going to do an abbreviated episode today. We are going to only hit one topic, but I think this is a topic that will continue to bring headaches and heartache to a lot of folks out there, because there's so much guidance out there. There's so many opinions on this topic. And I do not believe that in all cases, accurate information is being conveyed. So I'm going to pause for a minute. Terry, we left off with you last week because we didn't have enough time, even though I tried to allot you 16 minutes. We did not have enough time. So we're going to jump straight into talking about split shared services. So take it away. And I know Stephanie and Paul, you guys have some incredible examples and things to talk about as well.
Yeah, I think the split shared visits topic is going to be, I don't know, I think the bane of our existence, because is for 2024, AMA, which is CPT, they actually updated the information, and it looks like Medicare is going to go along with what their guidance is as well. But their Medicare or CMS, from what I'm hearing, is still going to say this is only allowed in the hospital setting, the facility setting. So they're not going to allow split or shared in the office. So first of all, keep that in mind. If you're a commercial plan that's going to allow it, make sure you have it in writing, because I've seen commercial plans in 2022 and 2023 say, well, we follow Medicare guidance, and offices were trying to use a split shared for a new patient in the office, not in, you know, not the billing directly under the provider that performed the service, and they had to send refunds. So first get that settled by any of your commercial plans, which guidance they're going by as far as the place of service. Second, one of the things that I actually really appreciate about the update for split shared visits is the fact that, and I'm right in my 2024 CPT book. Now I use the professional edition. It's on page 6, but they talk about that the provider that says by doing so, meaning they met the criteria, a physician or other QHP has performed two of the three elements used in the selection of the code level based on medical decision making. And so when they're talking about the overall risk, when they're talking about making sure that, you know, things are appropriate. Now, can you use time to report split shared visits? Yes, that's still an option, but time, remember, is going to be highly scrutinized by the payers because it can be so easily manipulated, especially non-face-to-face time that the people are saying, well, this is just how long it takes me, so let's just automatically put that in for every patient. The other thing, and this is where CMS hasn't addressed it, but I am inquiring to the point where they're probably sick of me by this point. If a scribe does the service, or if AI is used to help you with your documentation, can that time be used? So right now, no. So in 2023, it cannot. They have not addressed it for 2024, but I'm going to, and I hate to assume anything, because they haven't addressed it, it's just going to stay the same. Remember, any of the time elements has to be what's personally done by the provider. And if you are dictating to somebody who's doing your documentation, then you're not personally doing it. You're just talking out loud to the patient. Somebody else is providing that documentation for you. So the reason that they say patience over paperwork is that if you do the paperwork yourself and not hire somebody to do it, then you get to get paid for that time. But if you're paying somebody else to do it, you don't get paid, which kind of, I guess, is kind of counterproductive, only because you're paying somebody. So why shouldn't you get paid? But again, you're not providing it. But the one thing with splitter shared visits, I think that's going to be an issue, is the fact that the reason this even came out as an issue is because Medicare feels they're overpaying doctors for what the QHPs are doing, meaning nurse practitioners and PAs. The feeling is, and they are correct, by the way, the four of us have done enough auditing on splitter shared or hospital visits to know that it's really the mid-level providers, the nurse practitioners and PAs and clinical nurse specialists, that are doing everything. And the doctors, prior to the 2023 guidelines, were just going over and signing off or saying, I agree, and signing off. You can't do that anymore in a splitter shared visit. You actually have to do your substantive portion, either completing an entire portion of the medical decision making, or now it says 2 out of 3 elements. So make sure that you know that this has been updated, that there are things that are going to be looked at, and you still have to have the FS modifier submitted to identify that it's a splitter shared visit. And I'll send it over to Stephanie after this. That's one thing that I did see, for, because usually we see audits that are from things 2-3 years ago. I'm noticing that current audits from commercial plans who are using Medicare guidelines, and a couple of the TPE audits that I just saw with two clients, actually, they said that they were looking for the FS modifier that was not put on. It was billed under the physician, and it was not put on because, remember, that helps them data mine, collect information. You're hurting their stats. You're not allowing them to have their statistical information, so that costs them money. And if you don't bill it appropriately, they will take back money, whether you had the right level of service, whether you met all the other guidelines. If you didn't use the modifier, you didn't bill it appropriately. And I've seen them take back money on that. So Stephanie, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, so one thing I want to just throw in here before we talk a little more is reiterate what you were talking about with workflow, Terry, because one of the things that I get when I'm in sessions talking with groups about this who are not doing it appropriately, not documenting appropriately, we talk about the fact that, you know, if this feels like an attack on your workflow, it's because it is. You know, when we think about the staffing within hospitals, there are, you know, many times multiple APPs who are there, and they're going in to help with the volume of patients to save the physician time. So this is why it becomes so difficult to do this correctly, because this process is attempting to attack that workflow. We saw it when they were, you know, considering implementing time being the driving factor of whether or not you can split bill. They've put that off for another year at this point. So we still have the option of medical decision making or time being that driving factor. But there's a reason they're coming after it, because it's been done incorrectly against the guidelines, and they're just, you know, kind of closing your ability to continue to bill for that. Now, I have a lot that goes through my mind with this, because every single week I deal with this. And I just finished up with a client last week, and they were aware that one of their specialty departments had a problem in this area. And, you know, when we go in, the issue is, again, thinking back to workflow, is that we're seeing physicians add their addendum to the note, say that they saw and examined the patient, and say that they agree with the documented medical decision making or treatment plan, or however they want to say it. And that may have helped a little bit in the past, but now that's all completely out the door. We have to be able to see what the physician is personally doing. And I know when I work with my clients, there's a lot of frustration because the physicians are stating that they don't allow the APP to make their own independent treatment decision. They are helping with the work of the encounter, but the ultimate treatment decisions are decided by the physician, and then at times the APP will help carry that out. So we have to look to documentation first and foremost. The scenario, it's not that it doesn't matter, but when I'm auditing, the scenario doesn't matter at that time because I have to know what the surface value is within the documentation. So a lot of times I'm failing practices in general on that because we can't even see what the physician was doing personally. Now, on top of that, another thing that I'm finding, I actually have one client where the relationship between the physicians and APPs is unique because they have set it up where there is a collaboration agreement from the clinical level and what, you know, what a physician would have to do in the state and the scope of practice to oversee the work of an APP, but they're employed by two different entities. So the issue is constantly coming up in the audits that we're doing because clinically, the physicians and the APPs are not aware of what happens on the compliance side and what we're doing from a billing perspective. And every single time they are utilizing them in the way that you typically would for to save time and document for them, things like that. But the main issue is that we can't use it. They have different employers. So there's a lot of problems that exist here, but everybody on the administrative level and everybody on the clinical side has to understand on a deep level what these guidelines require, how it plays out in workflow, and then how it plays out from, you know, documentation standpoint. Paul, did you want to talk about that workflow?
Well, not so much the workflow. I wanted to just give a little bit of a background as to what we're going to be looking at in the future. In the last week, actually the last 3 days of last week, the annual AMA CPT symposium took place. And the reason why I always like to go there is that any time we have any type of CPT change or any type of thought process change, I like to go to the AMA CPT symposium because I want to know the rationale behind it. I mean, it's not enough to just say this is a new code for it. It's like, what is the rationale behind the change? So, as it came to split shared, you know, the AMA's philosophy is, okay, we're not going to have a CMS change in 2024, but we're going to try and telegraph a change for 2025 and make sure that we force the issue in order to change it. So they've changed their language a little bit. And the big reason for it was that clinicians felt that medical decision making, rather than more than 50% of the time, was really most relevant as far as making a level of service determination, you know, and they wanted to make certain that the CPT codes at the very least promoted team-based care. So, you know, there were some things that were brought out in the evaluation management session that was brought forward by Dr. Peter Holman, who's always entertaining, who brought some information to the point as to what we're looking for next year. And when, you know, at the point where you're using medical decision making in order to make a determination as to split shared visits, what the AMA has put forward is that the individual who approves the care plan for the problems addressed, and that's a whole other category of things we'll probably be talking about sometime after Thanksgiving, and takes responsibility related to the risk management for those, you know, addressed problems, or what I like to call, you know, meaningfully assessed problems, you know, that's going to be the person that gets credited as having performed the substantive portion of the visit. But there was also one interesting thing, and I know we've talked about data until we're blue in the face, and, you know, I'll be the first to come out and say I can't stand using data to make a determination for a level of service. But they did indicate that if data is used for selection of the medical decision-making level, and this is very interesting because Terry and I have talked about this, only the person who performs an independent interpretation or discussion of management of test results or test interpretation can use that category in order to credit themselves for medical decision making. So, you know, not only do you have to worry about the meaningfully assessed issues, but you also have to worry about, okay, who did the data portion of this? It's like, and this is clarification. Okay. Call me when you get there, because, you know, the devil is in the details.
Yeah, and Paul, real quick, you know, on that point, this is why I have such an issue with the notes that I'm reviewing, because when the physician chooses to have an NP or a PA document their notes for them, it looks like they did it. It looks like the APP performed every portion of that. We can't make assumptions. We have no idea that they had discussions, that they made the final decision. And I'm interested to get your thoughts from all of you, and Sean, you too, on this. When it comes to documentation, one of the things that I'm being asked about as a corrective action is if the physician can then go in and state that the notes of the NP or PA reflect their personal decisions. And it's like, I feel like they're saying the words, but we're skirting the line. And yes, that may meet like bare minimum, but that's still, it really worries me.
And I have an issue too,
because yeah, go ahead, Terry.
What's happening in the stuff that I am auditing is I can tell the difference. I don't know if it's just an innate quality or whatever, but I can tell the difference between an RN note and a QHP note. And not to discount RNs, we need our frontline worker RNs. We absolutely do. But remember what the AMA says about qualified healthcare professionals. And remember, in the language, to qualify for a split shared visit, it's an MD, DO, so it's a physician or qualified healthcare professional. And it basically says, a physician or other qualified healthcare professional is an individual who is qualified by education, training, licensure, regulation, and facility privileges, who performs a professional service within their own scope of practice and independently reports that professional service. So RNs can't independently report. They're considered clinical staff that have to bill under a supervised physician. So what I think happens a lot of times, especially now with hospitalists going into private practice, what's there is that the nurse visit, if you will, is now completely, I don't know if it's skewed, but I mean, I had somebody the other day say, well, I'm the nurse. I said, I'm just going to be a jerk here. Are you really? And they said, what? And I said, are you the RN, the NP? And she goes, actually, I'm a medical assistant, but they have us call us nurses here. And I went, okay, I need to go somewhere else. And with that, I'll send it to Sean, because those kinds of things make me crazy.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I've said for decades, okay, is that when it comes to guidelines that are specific to a payer, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever it may be, we don't submit our claims to the American Medical Association for reimbursement. We submit our claims to the payers, and that means we follow the payer guidelines. AMA, I think, for the most part, does a very good job of having providers' backs when it comes to trying to accurately define and create descriptions for services or procedures that are being performed. I think where the disconnect comes and what people have to recognize is that the AMA is not a government agency. They are not a payer. They do not create policy. They do not create legislation. They can petition CMS or payers to engage with them and collaborate and adopt AMA guidelines. And it's interesting, because if you read your participation agreements, many of them say we follow AMA CPT guidelines when it's convenient for them. So keep this in mind. Split shared services are a very unique service, much like Incident 2. They only really apply to Medicare. These are Medicare-specific terms. We had a little bit of an interesting conversation before we started for about a minute and a half regarding scribes. I think scribes are something that hospitals need to probably put a hold on right now, because I know a lot of physicians are extremely reliant on their scribes. But when it comes to these split shared services, the insurance companies aren't going to pull the metadata. Paul Spencer knows all too well what I'm talking about when I say audit trails and when I talk about keystroke audits and these types of things. The government's not going to do that. They're going to, on an audit, want to make certain that the person, i.e. physician or non-physician practitioner, who has performed a substantive portion, which includes the documentation, is actually the person performing those services. So I think there's a lot of risk, again, in split shared services. I blame hospitals. I was a hospital administrator for a lot of years in my early years. It was always something that aggravated me when we had compensation based on RVUs, because when you force somebody into an RVU compensation formula, that's how they make their money. And they're going to want every single RVU under their NPI number. And when you tell them that now the substantive portion goes to either the nurse practitioner or the PA who has performed that portion, physicians get bent. And this is where I could see a lot of problems coming down the pike. And I will tell you, don't think for a minute that the payers, you know, especially CMS, is going to relax their audits of split shared services. They're not. They're only going to increase, especially with the moratorium that they put on to not making the substantive portion change in 2023 and allowing it to have a 1 year, you know, hiatus. It's just like what happened when we came out of COVID. The floodgates opened and we entered into a new era of aggressive and overzealous audits. Folks, a lot of folks at the MACs, the UPICs, they don't fully understand incident two and split shared services. And it leaves a lot to their discretion. And it leads to a lot of subjectiveness on the part of an auditor. And I'm not criticizing them. I just believe that there's so much ambiguity in the way that the guidelines are written that it leads to a lot of open interpretation to what did Medicare actually mean about split shared services. All right, let me pause there. Go ahead, Terry.
I have a question for Paul. You went to the CPTN symposium?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so I haven't been in a couple of years, and last time I went, it was again a few years ago, and it was awesome. Like you said, it's nice to get that feedback, and here is way before COVID. But I have a question as far as when they were talking about these services and talking about the team aspect of split shared. Did the question come up from the audience or any of the AMA panel about how clinical staff are being used in a lot of these instead of really QHP and MD? DOs, because it seems like in a hospital setting, that would be hard to track.
Yeah. I think there was one very brief question that got a few chuckles during a Q&A session from not only providers, but a couple of the MAC medical directors who tend to populate the AMA CPT symposium in order to provide kind of a, as best they can, a bridge between the AMA changes and the policy impact of that at different carriers, and it basically dealt with, using an NP as a scribe, which is a tremendous waste of resources. If anybody out there is doing that, I don't know why you would pay a nurse practitioner salary for a court reporter. That seems incredibly wasteful to me. But for the most part, I mean, most of the questions that we get in Q&A sessions at the AMA CPT symposium are broken down based on the sessions that immediately preceded that Q&A session. So there are six altogether with about 15 different sessions related to specific coding changes to specific specialties, and each Q&A session is focused on that. So there was really one Q&A session for E&M with one straggler spilling into QA session two and confusing everybody that was on screen because most of it is virtual. But they didn't really talk about the specifics of resource utilization.
Do they talk about time? Because what I'm finding is the non-face-to-face time is becoming a problem. I had a provider that basically the total time of the visit was 80 minutes. And so he was going to get the highest level E&M in the hospital. And his service was 72 minutes of non-face-to-face. Never saw the patient.
Yeah.
And the QHP was the other 8 minutes. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And he goes, I could do everything from my office. He goes, this is great. I love this change. And,
you know, well, an E&M service still requires a face-to-face encounter. You know, I mean, you know, come on now. I mean, you can do non-face-to-face work, but you still have to see that patient on the date all of that information was collected. I mean, that's...
But Sean, let me take it from a defense position. So if it's not black and white that says you have to see the patient face to face, it's just what Paul and I and Stephanie and you think is best practices and common sense. If the patient's sick enough to be in the hospital, somebody should see them.
Yeah.
How do you tell physicians not to do something that they don't give a black and white answer to?
Yeah. So, you know, 10 days ago, I was in my sixth federal criminal trial, civil or criminal trial in the last 14 months. And it is always interesting to me to watch prosecutors and the liberties that they take in making their own interpretation as to what a subregulatory guidance document actually says. For me, when I'm talking to a jury, I always point out that things are ambiguous, they're vague, and they're done that way for a reason, because it allows for a lot of latitude. It allows for the government to make a lot of different types of interpretations. I mean, listen, think about this, right? Everybody wants to talk about LCDs, NCDs, all of these different things, right? But what happens? Here's a prime example. What happens in the event that there is no LCD or NCD? Where does somebody go to make a determination? Well, Medicare has a section in the Program Integrity Manual. It's Chapter 3. It's 3.6.2.1 that talks about medical necessity. And it says in the absence of an LCD or NCD, you have to meet the following criterion in order to be able to satisfy it. Well, the problem is if you read that, that section's as vague or ambiguous as the primary section. And that is what I was trying to do last week, about 10 days ago, when, you know, I was talking to the jury and trying to help them. See, prosecutors want to make things very black and white, okay? Because that's their job. And remember, the job of an attorney in a courtroom is to tell a story. It's to tell a story that from a plaintiff or prosecution standpoint, that once they have created a narrative, they create the story to fit that narrative. A defense attorney's responsibility is to blow up that narrative and to be able to say, not so fast. And, you know, listen, there are certain services that I tell my clients to avoid. Incident two, I tell my clients to avoid them like the plague. Split shared services, I tell them as best you can, avoid it. I understand in a hospital setting, you're always using non-physician practitioners to come around. When I've been in the hospital, I've had the nurse practitioner from the cardiology group come in to see me. And, you know, I never see the cardiologist, but when I get my EOB, it's always billed under the cardiologist. And so, you know, these are the things that, you know, you've got to pay attention to, because these are the things that the insurance companies are paying attention to. And like I said, data is key. These insurance companies know better what you all as hospitals, health systems, and physician practices are doing before you even know what you're doing yourself. So be careful on this. And I will leave you with this. Of the six cases that I've been involved in now for the last 12 months, all six of these providers have been acquitted and found not guilty of Medicare fraud. All six of these cases, including the one last week. And I can't wait to do my podcast and talk about what a horrific creature this last prosecutor was. I wouldn't even call this person human. They were a creature. They were despicable. But I got to be careful with what I say. So I will leave it at that for right now. Hey, listen, you know, I'm just speaking the truth. Wait till you all hear what this. Oh, boy. Okay.
I like to read horror novels, Sean. I like to read horror books, and you sound like you're describing one of the characters.
Yeah, but folks, I'm telling you, I'm trying to work through how I can actually do this podcast on this case. When you hear what this case involved, I think many of you are going to cringe. So what I will say is, when I announce that podcast, get your popcorn ready, sit back, kick your feet up, and enjoy the show. All right. Anything else that we have on Split Shared Services? Terry, Stephanie, Paul, I think you guys have done a great job and really put forth a great discussion on this topic. And hopefully it gives all of the listeners a lot to think about on how they're going to handle split shared services, especially now with the significant change coming about in 2024.
I would recommend that practices get a plan together on how they're going to handle it in consistency in their practice, and make sure that they educate their providers before going into 2024. I think 2023 has been kind of a mess. 2022 is worse. And so I think as 2024 comes about, especially with the updated guidance, it'd be nice that everybody was on the same page, everybody knew how it worked, and making sure that you have, again, something in writing that you can go back to the physician and say, this is our policy. This is how we're going to handle it. And everyone needs to agree to it. Otherwise, you're going to have providers all over the place. And it's amazing how once, and we all know this, when we do training, it's really good for the next 3 months. And then everyone loses their mind after that.
If you're lucky.
And you have to remind them, yeah, what you talked about 3 months ago. So just have a plan in place. Remember, this is the compliance guy. Compliance is everything. And it means basically having direction in writing where somebody can refer back to know how things work and the directions and where you're going.
Yeah. Excellent. And I just want to add to that. If you find issues, you need to correct those issues. This isn't something where we're saying, you know, get your stuff together, get your stuff in line, like Terry's saying. And today going forward, let's be better at it. You know, with the client I just finished up with, I had a meeting with their administrative level staff beginning of last week. Some of the providers, the physicians, only co-signed the note. There was never even an addendum and not one word documented by the physician. Other physicians in the group just said that they saw the patient and agreed with the APP's note. So they're looking at 100% error rate when it comes to documentation of split shared. So we have to make sure that you realistically look at what your obligation is to now clean up the past as well as go forward. You know, I know sometimes that that's a gray area or a fine line, but when there's 100% error rate of split shared documentation, that is a problem. You have to address that. Even if the workflow would have supported it, you now are left with years worth of bad documentation, and you have to consider what you're going to do with that.
Absolutely. All right, Paul, any final thoughts?
I think we've covered this topic top to bottom. I just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. And as Arlo Guthrie would warn you, don't throw any trash over a cliff in Stockbridge, Massachusetts.
All right. I've got nothing else to add after that. So listen, Terry and I will be back tomorrow for another hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. We got a really good one for you tomorrow. We're looking forward to it. As Paul said, on behalf of myself and our great panel, We'd like to wish you all a happy and healthy Thanksgiving. Thank you for always hanging out with us for a little while each and every single Monday when we're on. We'll be back next Monday for one of our final episodes, not the final, but one of our final episodes of the Monday Coding and Compliance Roundtable for 2023. So we hope that y'all will tune in and hang out with us then. But until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.